My subject is overcoming obstacles to effective civil defense. The obstacles are started long before Clinton, and as Robinson just said, I'm not aiming.
That's fine. I just wanted to turn it off for the feedback. There's a feedback.
All right. I have such a loud voice that I don't need a speaker, really. I gave one time when I was in China, I gave calisthenics to about 4,000 Chinese with no amplification system at all, up on top of a adobe platform about this high with Chinese at, of course, they have to be this far apart. And maybe I should just play like these people are Chinese.
Okay.
Well, my subject, which Jane Orr allowed me to pick, is overcoming obstacles to effective civil defense. And I'm going to present information on the obstacles in four countries, in China, in Russia, in Israel, and in the United States. Obviously, these are very different in these very disparate countries. I'll emphasize psychological and political difficulties that all nations must overcome in attaining effective civil defense. And these are very different between these very different totalitarian countries on one hand and democratic countries on the other. Well, I'll start by taking a look at Chinese civil defense preparations. In particular, their interconnected blast shelters. Most of you have read the accounts, and I had a unique opportunity in two separate years, in 81 and 82, I was an official guest of the Chinese government, which in those days was, that's way back, I would say 81, 82, it was more communistic, and the situation was very different in that the United States regarded China as a balance against the major threat, which was the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union, then as now, had, of course, far more nuclear weapons, and they certainly were targeted on the United States largely. The Chinese built their tunnels after Mao concluded that a Soviet attack on China was very likely. And this effort was monumental. They, in a few years, starting roughly 1950, they made these tunnels under the Chinese cities, a little down in the countryside. And the estimated amount of material that went into building these shelters, largely tunnels, interconnected, has been estimated as equal to the materials that went into the Great Wall of China, and really several walls of China, over several hundred years, at least equal some estimates that I think are credible, twice as much materials. Well, how did they do it that rapidly? They made a mobilization mainly of the people living in these threatened cities, and the people really believed they were threatened, and I think they were, that bit of Chinese propaganda was correct. The concept that Mao and his, well, Mao had primarily, was an attack with A-bombs of about the size, or maybe a little bigger, but small compared to the H-bombs that came along not much later. And these would be airburst, as we airburst the two weapons on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Well, if you assume airburst and only a few of them, you don't have to have a shelters built for long occupancy. Obviously, the fallout is, as everybody knows now, at Hiroshima and Nagasaki was negligible. And The tunnels were built largely on, I think, the basis of how the Chinese evacuated cities. And I was privileged, I was with OSS in China in the year before the end of World War II, and also extending into the next year. And I happened to be outside of Kunming, which is in extreme southwestern China, as the Japanese were invading, starting at the coast. And our general, who was the head of the Chinese forces over there, not Chinese, the American Air Forces over there, Chennault, he stated, with air power we can stop a ground attack. Well, the Japanese attack didn't pay hardly any attention to the bombardment. I saw a bit of the way they moved across country, and it was impressive. Their coolie trains, you know, with tin poles across their shoulders, and moving across especially grasslands on a moonlight night were a sight to behold. You might say, from a Russian or an American standpoint, ants moving forward. And if one got sick, too bad. They didn't. They were ruthless in that respect. And the logistics, the weight relative to the amount of transportation needed, made any truck transport look inefficient. I'm talking about 200, 300 miles of that kind of a supply of ammunition and food. Well, getting back to Kunming, the sirens sounded one night, and I went from the OSS headquarters out on a barren little hill overlooking the city. And they didn't have shelters at that time to mount anything. And the murmur of those tens of thousands of Chinese moving on foot out of their city was one of the impressive sounds I've heard in my life. I think the tunnels were built on the same principle of people could move away from, say, where there'd been a nuclear explosion, and perhaps the tunnels were caved in. And then they had various ways, you see, they could walk survivors of the immediate area away from that area and away from the fires that would certainly follow those explosions. And I'm quite sure that was the basis of the elaborate tunnel system that the Chinese built several years later. Well, what are the disadvantages of that system? First, they didn't provide for not only moving away from the areas that were immediately threatened with fire or with, well, they didn't count on much fallout to get away from there, but they should have made their tunnels extend out into the countryside, and then they could get out and disperse. Ed York, who I regret is not here at this meeting, he made calculations on that basis, and they could have gotten away at least until the Soviets had an overwhelming nuclear arsenal, of course including big weapons which could be ground burst and still cause the destruction of those small Chinese cities, small in area. Well, the one of the obvious weaknesses of the shelter system is lack of adequate ventilation. They weren't even considering having to stay in with for fallout, holding down. Of course, air bursts, as I've already said, caused very little fallout. So, as I said, in those days, we, the United States, were considering the Chinese as a balance against the Soviet Union. And I went over there as a private citizen, paying my own expenses until I got to China. This is a very strange situation, in that I was invited by the Chinese government after some of my friends at the Hudson Institute, including the founder of the Hudson Institute, Herman Kahn, had been over there advising the Chinese on nuclear strategic matters, and I'd been at the Hudson Institute, and they knew that I had some ideas, well, more than ideas, on how to ventilate shelters, and they immediately saw these high-level Americans, professional strategists, that they had a bad deficiency in their ventilation of shelters. Well, I have to give a biography of my autobiography of myself before I was given not only all the official paper, normal official papers, but was given a red carpet treatment. And of course, I put down, the Chinese already knew it, that I'd served with OSS, Office of Strategic Services, in China, and CIA is a successor of OSS, and the fact that I said I wasn't in any wise connected with the CIA, well, of course, they thought I was lying. And I don't blame them in their society. The idea of an individual on one trip by himself and on the second trip with his wife going to China at his own expense and not being, you might say, subservient to any government agency, it just doesn't enter their world. Well, getting back to this problem of ventilation, let's see, I'll take this off. I've drafted my daughter for many uses in civil defense. She's been a guinea pig, and my other daughters in testing shelters, even in sub-freezing heated shelters, trench shelters, in sub-freezing Colorado. Wait a minute, I think I'm disconnecting the wrong connection. Here, you can. Let me see. Here we go. Let's just forget about this. The big hook. My voice is loud enough. Anybody in the rear can't hear me? All right.
They can't hear.
You're
fairly mobile with this. You can walk around.
All right. So I'm going to operate the fan right now.
Okay.
All right. Here. Well, you can put that down, and you be the wind catcher. The Chinese had some good fans, copies of Swiss fans, blowers, and but they just it was completely inadequate for ventilation except in freezing weather. And one of the devices that I'd, of course, designed primarily for Americans if we continued to have no shelters and no instructions.
Here.
You sure
they can't hear you back there.
They can't hear me. Well, it maybe the acoustics of outdoors in China was perhaps better than here. maybe I've gotten 83 years old and obviously I can't talk as loud as I used to. No, if you come up on stage. Well, one invention I made, which was I called it the punk-a-pump, directional punk-a-pump, because it was based on punkas, these mats that I'd seen in India and Burma that are swung by a punkawala, a servant that just sits there and pulls on a string, but they weren't directional. But anyway, I greatly improved that by making a flap device, which, as I said, I called the punka pump, since it directed the flow of air, and the Office of Civil Defense renamed it the Kearney Air Pump, KAP. But if you're in a hurry, and the Chinese would be pushed for space for that type of device, but they could use a fan like this, and you see, you just go like this. Am I not finding your head? There. Well, in the Chinese shelter factory, they quickly made five, or maybe it's only four, fans like this, and one of the shelter systems that I went to was in Dalian, that's near North Korea, across the saltwater separation there, Yellow Sea. And it was interesting to go into one of these tunnels. A full colonel of the Chinese army, who was a tall man, and he looked like a real warrior. He'd been fighting against Russians at one time, and of course against the communists, Chinese. And I easily explained what I was trying to demonstrate, and he called on three workmen. And they quickly caught on to the idea, and we got spaced down at a tunnel about, as I recall, 60, 70 meters between the blast doors, or in other words, opened those doors, and we were forcing air flow through. And I got a compliment that he through the interpreter said that he didn't know that capitalists could work that hard. The idea, you see, of a capitalist, I told him I had a farm and raised wheat, and he was very much interested in that. He came from the north and wheat growing. And how many families are on your farm? And I said, there isn't any family. A man and his two sons, they have their own farm, and they also farm my farm. And that really puzzled him out. Well, they've changed by now. Well, here, let's move on to a different type of... I think I'm still hooked up.
Yeah.
Maybe you be.
You can
what? Well, this is a device for in big hallways, in hallways. I've had Americans using this type of a two-person directional fan, bid sheet fan, and the biggest tests we ran were in a big limestone mine outside of Kansas City. This was a tremendous mine. The ceilings were almost this tall. And the trucks went in on one entrance, and then they could circle various ways. Of course, they left columns and go out another. And with five pairs of bedshed fans like this, we quickly had a rectangular flow of air going in and down a passageway and back and around about 100,000 cubic feet a minute. Now, people would get tired doing this for more than, I'd say, 15 or 20 minutes. But if you have thousands of people in a shelter, as the Chinese would have in some of their big shelters, and organization, it's practical. I'm not saying I'm going to advocate this immediately if American civil defense is resurrected, because it takes organization and all. Well, anyway, we're trying to pump air this way. And you go this way, and then over, and change hands, and I said, well, I may be wired for sound, but I thought you were going to be a wild man here. Here we go. Well, I think everybody could see what happened. One. Two. Three. Where's the air moving? It's going the wrong direction. Here, I think it's going this way. Because there has to be a boss man, and I'm setting the pace, and I'm used to dominating women, so you see. Well, anyway, you'll have to believe you can move if you have the manpower or woman power, and a system of society where one person is allowed to dominate. It works.
would have been more efficient if you had a roof or something, so that instead of going...
yes, that motion was waste energy. The birds are not up there to benefit it. I lost confidence, you see, and typed all this out, whereas I really didn't need it. So I'm just flipping pages now to be sure I didn't leave something out. Well, as I said, I taught the Chinese quite a good deal of survival and information, and as anticipated, I don't think any of the information was ever passed on to the people who would desperately need it if China was under nuclear attack. The reason is obvious. In a dictatorship, if you have to put in something after the, say, something as expensive and big as the shelter system is made, that's a proof that Mao and all his successors didn't know what they were doing, or they wouldn't need shelters that needed to be seriously modified. And the information could have been useful to people out in the countryside, but I got the impression that the new ruling class of China, thought they probably had too many people anyway. And they wanted certainly to preserve the workers and people around them. I was going to these various cities. So they had they didn't put red carpets out, but I had, of course, an interpreter with me and officers assigned to me to show me the sights, and it was really a unique experience. Well, let's touch just on Russia. I have not been in Russia, but I've talked to people, including Maccabee, who was over there, and saw some of their urban shelters in Moscow and had adventures in them, and especially Ed York, who has studied them in detail, and of course Leon Garay and other people that have studied the Russian civil defense system. Well, they estimated that the Soviet cities, they counted really on a first strike, although they didn't say officially, but they counted on knocking out most of our retaliatory forces before the nuclear war started, before just in the first salvos of a nuclear war. The Russians, or rather the Soviet Union, counted on knocking them out. Strangely enough, they did not interconnect their excellent blast shelters, excellent except for, I'd say, long-term ventilation in hot weather. The Soviets didn't interconnect these shelters. This is very strange because of World War II, such as the bombing and the firestorm in Dresden, those ghosts were staring them in the face. And it's a mystery to me that they didn't interconnect, because they did make good calculations on the depth of rubble in their cities, with different types of buildings and different sizes and types of buildings, on the average depth of the smoldering rubble. They correctly didn't think there'd be firestorms, but they counted on certainly fire and smoldering rubble. Well, then they made another very strange mistake, in that the air intakes of their shelters were practically at ground level, often protected by a concrete, what you call them, a reinforced concrete monument like this, with louvered openings for the air intake. This is the ones that had, most of them had some powered fan air pump equipment, and that meant if their calculations of the depth and type of smoldering rubble, of course producing carbon monoxide, was correct. They'd be pumping carbon monoxide into the shelters, and they'd be as dead as the many of the survivors were in the basements of Dresden, who didn't die from lack of oxygen, which was reported, and they didn't die from being killed by the heat. They died from carbon monoxide. What the Russians at present are doing about their whole shelter system, their conflicting reports, and judging from the way many of the, well, their army especially has gone to pieces practically, I wouldn't say it's in functioning shape. But the shelters still exist, and they are a war-fighting asset. Well, one of the interesting developments to me was what the Chechens, you know, the Chechens are, well, their revolution has been won against Russia now. And they, at some stage, made their shelters interconnected. This had a great advantage because, as no doubt many of you have read, they had not only rifles and, of course, TNT and other explosives, but they had Russian-produced RPG-7s, these shoulder-fired anti-tank, anti-armored car weapons that they just, I've seen them, captured ones, numerous ones, in Vietnam. I was over there with the science advisor at the height of that miserable war, and they shoot a rocket, RPG means rocket propelled grenade, and is about this big around, that long. Well, it didn't look like a grenade to me, but that's the name that sticks with it. And with one of those, a man at up to 200 meters, if he practiced with it, and a good shot, he could shoot at a tank, and it would go through, I've read up to 16 inches of armor plate if it didn't hit it at an angle. Well, what happened to the Russian tanks in Grozny, the capital of the Chechens, and in other cities? The Chechens could go underground through their urban shelters and pop up at the right place to attack Russian tanks, and it wasn't any 200 meters either. They were right next to them in many cases. And there were pictures on TV of whole columns of smoldering Russian tanks knocked out by men on foot. And in a book that I'm have finished writing, but now I'm I want to thank Robinson, Art Robinson, because when I was struggling along for a large part of the last 8 years on this book, not struggling in the sense of financial difficulties or anything, but just old age, I'd say, and Art came to the psychological rescue and assured me that if I didn't find a publisher, that he and, of course, the Doctors for Disaster Preparedness would get the book out. Well, with that digression, I'll say that I really don't know the status of Russian civil defense at present, but their shelters still exist and are a major asset. A brief look now at Israeli civil defense. They have, I'd say, the best existing civil defense system in the world for defense against ordinary HE high explosives and against poison gas. They received very favorable publicity for the buildup of the 100 days of actual ground fighting and the attack with Scuds on Israeli cities. Well, that started a bit before the ground fighting. But their provisions of gas masks for everyone. Babies, those weren't exactly masks, little boxes where the mother could pump filtered air into the baby, little tiny baby, and small gas masks for children, and of course for variety sizes of adults. And the strangest ones were the ones which I haven't seen written up, but I learned from Yaakov, can't pronounce my ancient Jewish names, Y-A-A-K-O-V, Lapidot. He was director of Israeli Civil Defense doing the build-up to the war, that is, the Gulf War period. And he, I think with justice, was proud of himself because he even had masks that you can't, a heavily bearded man, you can't put the mask and make it airtight over his face. So you have to go down, have the whole sort of bag-like contraption that goes around and closes around his neck. And I asked, well, why didn't they, couldn't they cut off their beards? But some ultra-Orthodox Jews, they'd rather be killed and die of gas poisoning than cut off their beard. So, on biological attack, especially with anthrax, the gas masks would do them some good if they had warning. But I haven't heard yet of a system of warning that can give warning against spores of anthrax, which of course you can't even start to see them with your naked eye. And there are many other organisms in the wind that would fool you on that score. You'd think it was anthrax. But at least they have masks. Well, the strangest omission of all of Israeli civil defense is that they make no mention of defense against nuclear weapons. And the best answer I've received to that, and I made two trips as just a private, unbacked citizen to Israel and got a very good reception over there. But I didn't get as good an answer to this question of why don't you mention nuclear, radiation? Well, by coincidence, I live in western Colorado, and I was swimming in a hot pool, naturally hot pool, and I looked across the pool, and there I saw obviously a very intellectual Jew and his wife and a child. And so I swam across and made their acquaintance, and soon was western Colorado is impoverished as regards intellectual Jews. And I'm not making that facetious, because the most there's a higher incidence of intellectual Jews that have helped me in my projects than any other, we won't call it a race, but a type of people. Well, anyway, my wife was away, and they were camping out, and were going to drive by my home, or within less than a mile of my home, the following morning. So I invited them to breakfast and rushed back, and as usual, when May is away, the house was a mess, so I cleaned up at least downstairs and bought some of the appropriate foods, and they showed up on time, and we looked out from our picture windows across a peaceful valley toward the distant big San Juan Mountains, and this man, he said he could understand how we could think about nuclear war much more easily than he could. In other words, a big country and places where there was lots of space and few people and plenty of water and so forth, that made it easier to think. And I think I know he was right. I've had a much easier time thinking about nuclear war when I'm in my home in western Colorado than when I'm, say, right here, or let alone in New York City or Boston. But I got around to talking about self-help civil defense, and I showed him one of my little fallout meters, which I've demonstrated around here. You see instruments of this type being sold right out now. But anyway, I'll show you an improvement I made and why I didn't make it before I wrote the instructions, which are given in detail for making a home makeable an accurate and dependable fallout meter. They're in this book, Nuclear War Survival Skills. I'll digress on this. Some 600,000 copies have been sold worldwide. Of course, this was a time when nuclear war was considered much more credible than nuclear war is today, most of them. However, under President Reagan, the man he had made Director of Civil Defense, Lieutenant General retired Julius Becton, he bought a total of close to 10,000 of these from Art Robinson's, or his organization, and distributed them largely to civil defense, or rather they call them FEMAs now, FEMA professionals. And they actually, in some of their classes for professionals, they were making these little meters and learning considerable about radiation and the effects and so forth, and how to make something that would work. Well, you don't have to know what Clinton did. He not only has, in the process of disposing, which is eliminating, our stocks of radiation instruments. In 1986, we had approximately, approximately 600,000 dose rate meters and 3.6 million dosimeters. This was an investment, and I think it was the strongest part of American civil defense, which has been weak, admittedly, but at least they had a way that would enable ordinary people to scattered over the country to learn what the radiation danger was from fallout. So it was consistent with Clinton's policy that to get rid of not only the instruments, but also information on how to make an expedient instrument or an expedient shelter or a expedient ways of ventilating a basement along with that program. Some have been saved. Jane Orient and Sharon Packer, who is here today, they saved some of them, the Arizona instruments, and Art Robinson has been saving by just getting them loaned or given to him, and he puts them in storage, some in Oregon, and a friend of mine in Kentucky has been doing the same thing out there. But other than those few tens of thousands, I'm speaking now of the mainly dosimeters, they're gone. What motivates Clinton to do this is hard to understand. I can't understand it. Well, I didn't put in my instructions, as I said, which I regret having done. Most people, if they make such an instrument, or is it given to them, or they buy it in a perceived crisis, they don't keep it for long. It gets lost somehow. All people normally want to believe that nuclear war is incredible. It's not going to happen. Well, anyway, here's one that I had in this jar for, it is color indicator silica gel, but it was is now blue, and it changes when it's no longer a good drying agent to a sort of a whitish or a light pinkish white color. So with an ordinary peanut butter jar and your instruments, I won't put it, just the remaining, put the charging wire in and connect it to the, but in a bag like this, it has silica gel in it too, which remained partly blue after 3 years when I opened it up just 4 days ago for the first time. But it was ready to go, no batteries, and always accurate if its simple mechanical parts are in their proper relationship to each other. Well, that is what you call a discouraging, in many ways, hope, because a little better than 10 years ago, scientists, engineers at both Oak Ridge National Laboratory and Los Alamos made breadboard models that were not based on, well, they were, they'd have to make, breadboard means just spread out of available parts, but to make one for the average citizen, they would have to produce a chip which might at that time have cost $3 million. And of course that just completely ruled it out, the government, the idea of making instruments that are much more modern than any of the types made now, as far as I know, anywhere. Nuclear war just wasn't that serious a risk. Well, this fear of the word nuclear bomb radiation, it's worldwide, and it's one of the worst obstacles, the hardest to overcome obstacles to, I'd say, serious civil defense anywhere, except perhaps in a complete dictatorship. And as far as I know, such a dictatorship, to that extent, doesn't exist today. Well, can experienced civil defense does not appeal to the governments or the military of any country, I'd say. I think in view of Clinton completing the destruction of what little we had of a civil defense system, I think that the United States Army in a perceived crisis would be imposed on having that responsibility. Our military doesn't want anything to do with it because it's worse than a case of worms, a can of a bucket of worms, a garbage can full of worms. No matter what you do, you're going to anybody in charge of a war-related civil defense system, any organization is going to be in continual trouble. Well, the nuclear end of it is there's a clearer cut problem there than there is for preparations to increase the number of survivors from a poison gas attack on the United States. And the situation as far as biological attack, of course, is way worse. It's interesting that when I was in Vietnam at the height of the that war, during the Tet Offensive, before and after the Tet Offensive, two or three of my friends were strongly in favor of our ending the war promptly and getting the hell out of there by using small nuclear weapons. I wasn't a part of the, you might call it, internal debate at all. But I thought that would be really stupid. Not that I didn't approve of what President Truman did at Hiroshima and Nagasaki. He ended the war, of course, by using them. But the complication there is, over in Vietnam, that the Chinese, of course, had numerous nuclear weapons, and so did the Russians. And I was looking at captured Russian RPG-7s and all kinds of machine guns and rifles and everything else. And what would prohibit either the Chinese or the Russians from receiving just a few small nuclear weapons, and they could use them to knock out, they wouldn't have to have a missile launcher, they got in big sacred charges and all, they could carry them to the outskirts, which they could attack and hold at any time of these concentrations of American troops over there. And it would have started, it would have crossed the nuclear threshold, and I believe that that threshold is one that we should be very careful not to cross. If our conventional forces continue going down, being degraded, and under Clinton they're going down at an astonishing rate, and of course the whole American Congress is responsible for that, I think it's quite likely that we will follow the Russians not following them and talking about it as following, but we'll depend, if our vital resources like oil are really threatened, that we'd be first to use nuclear weapons. Now, under Bush, I believe we destroyed all of our small nuclear weapons, leaving us only with ICBMs. And to go from, it makes no sense at all to threaten to blow up, say, Saddam Hussein when he gets his army back together again, and we don't think he has a nuclear weapon, to threaten him with nuclear destruction, or his armies with nuclear destruction, with ICBMs and megaton nuclear weapons, I don't think it's a credible threat. Oh, forget it. Obviously, I have no solution to offer to that one. The problem with biological warfare is even more complicated, in that, as I've already mentioned, there's really no way of detecting when you're under attack in time to respond promptly. And there are ways of dispersing, especially the spores of anthrax, where in many cases you wouldn't know where the attack is coming from. Reed Irwin today mentioned the theory that the plane that was shot down over Long Island Sound, 200 and some Americans killed, passengers killed, that the some ship may very well have launched it. And what ship? Who knows? So, how big a missile it takes to shoot down a big airliner, I frankly don't know. When the news of the downing of this ship that fell, as you know, scattered, blew up, or was blown up, and fell into Long Island Sound came out, I phoned Ed York, who's an expert on these matters, and he ruled out the possibility that it was an improved Stinger. The Stinger, of course, being the shoulder-fired weapon, heat-seeking weapon, that we supplied to the anti-communists in Afghanistan. And General Vono, at that time was Army Chief of Staff, credited that one little shoulder-fired weapon as the decisive weapon in the whole war. The Russians lost, I think it was 260-some planes, not only helicopters, but jet aircraft, combat aircraft, with an expenditure of, I think we had, there were actually fired about 350 or thereabouts Stingers. Now that is a situation which I'm sure is going to come before long, because these weapons, they cost about, I've read, about $35,000, and they've been, CIA has been trying to buy ones that were not used, and even 3 years ago they were selling for five times that amount, in other words, $150,000. And we've been in the process just recently. We promised to supply Taiwan for Taiwan's defense against, of course, China, Communist China, with 200, no, it was about 100 of the Stingers, each one in an armored car, so they could rush around that island and be in a position to shoot down attacking Chinese planes. Well, then again, if you can get $250,000 in a country where your soldiers aren't making that kind of money, they receive their pay in gold, how are you going to control those Stingers? So I think Stingers are the Chinese equivalent, which I understand are essentially, from the Chinese standpoint, being manufactured. When they're getting scattered around the world, and the Russians may very well, some Russians are hard up, so there's a source, and I'm puzzled as to why terrorists haven't gotten hold of these weapons yet. Apparently they haven't, because as Reed Irwin was describing, the missile, and I think it was a missile that went through the big airliner but did not explode, just tore a big hole through in passing through it. That shows, well, I think my guess is why the facts of that aren't coming out is just too disturbing a possibility. I think air travel would become, it will become much less popular and have all kinds of economic and other side effects if even a single plane is shot down by a Stinger or a Chinese or Russian counterpart of it. Well, staying on weapons for a little while, just last month, Army Times said that announced that the Javelin was finally being dispersed to quite a few troops. Well, most people here have heard of Stingers, but the Javelin is a heat-seeking, shoulder-fired weapon that has not an explosive charge of the type that's needed to knock down aircraft, but an armor-penetrating shaped charge. And it's a shoot-and-forget weapon, in other words, up to 2 kilometers, call it 1.6 miles, a foot soldier can aim at, say, a tank where its motor's running, it's hot, or an armored car, or a truck, and squeeze off, and then he can duck. In other words, the missile takes over and just goes like a Stinger does to its target. So one of the main, you might call it, thesis of my forthcoming book, Jungle Snafus and Remedies, is that while we're concentrating on super expensive weapons, including helicopters costing tens of millions of dollars apiece and various other aircraft, and a country that can use its wealth to buy these foot soldier weapons is going to be in a situation that will make people as worried as the commanders of our forces in recent maneuvers in the Nevada desert. They've been always defending their tanks, trying to, against other tanks and armored cars and artillery. And here they're up, we're up in those maneuvers for the first time, that they have to keep track of, try to locate a man on foot over a mile away. I'm infantry myself, and I think, unfortunately for us in the long run, the man on foot is going to be increasingly important in determining the outcome of most wars. But back very briefly to the some problems that are highlighted, are gone in considerable detail in this book, which is entitled A Higher Form of Killing. And Conrad Chester, who was a chemist and specialized in especially unconventional weapons, he recommended it not for its conclusion, but for a great deal of the information that they quote their sources, and they quote sources including the fact that Churchill was strongly in favor of using chemical weapons, including in the to clear the way for the Normandy invasion and to clear the way for Allied forces after they had crossed the beaches in Normandy and were fighting their way and having great difficulties in getting into the toward the interior of Germany. And even more disturbing than that, in this book, the anthrax weapons, which I knew had been developed in England, but I didn't realize until I read in here with proper citations of where the information came from, that the main production of anthrax weapons was to be in the United States. They were primitive compared to the ways of dispersing anthrax spores now, in that they were bomblets weighing about 5 pounds each, and it took to kill a mere 2 million people, took over 2,000 bombers, they figured, to drop the men these bomblets. And at Virgo, Indiana, they set up, the Americans set up a factory to produce 50,000 a month of these. That factory never went into operation. Very small scale production was initiated in and carried through in England. And Churchill was in favor of using those on German cities. And my opinion of Churchill went down after reading that, in that if you use nuclear weapons, as everybody here knows, it isn't the end of occupancy by any means. Look at Hiroshima and Nagasaki, even if there's fallout. But if you put anthrax all over what was a city, who's going to go live there for many years afterwards? I think President Roosevelt, who along with the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the British High Generals, they let thumbs down on that idea. So if people like Churchill, who he was, and that wasn't in a desperate situation, that was toward the end of the war. Well, he goes on to a lot of detail that I didn't know in detail. The CS, we still call them in this country gas grenades, meaning they're tear gas. Well, CS is much worse than what was called and much countries call tear gas, and now that's accepted by most nations, that form of chemical warfare. But one last quote. This book ends up as proof that the authors are humanitarians and all, and they state, this was written in 1982, the present arsenals, that is poison gas, are huge. Adequate stocks of nerve gas in the United States is sufficient to kill the entire population of the world 4,000 times over. Well, I've heard of exaggerations of the effectiveness of killing ability of nuclear weapons, but I never heard of they killing the whole world 4,000 times over. I thank you, and we'll all pray that nightmares don't come true. I don't think there's any time for any questions. This gentleman here was making very effective signals, but I'm stubborn, and to shut up, he had enough. And I think most Americans are in his shoes. They want to think about what I've been talking about.
All right. Karen Packard.
Possibility of a meteorite colliding with our world. It seems that nuclear war probably is the most disastrous of any of the concerns that we have talked about. What do you think we can do as a group, as individuals, to awaken the people to this terrible threat that continues to be a possibility?
I think if the work that the Doctors for Disaster Preparedness first informing on the limitations of, say, chemical attack, biological attack, the global warming, shoot down that false fear, and this type contributes to preparing the ground for a serious civil defense. I'm not talking about a few thousand or a few tens of thousands of people, such as you are one of the spark plug leaders of. And we certainly need more, but that isn't what I consider national civil defense. How to fight the combination or counter the media and most intellectuals, and on something that you've been making preparations on, that is the distribution of stable potassium iodide as a prophylactic against the uptake of radioactive iodine from a single weapon. That's the kind of information, I won't go into that, but I spent a fair amount of time trying to convince Science Magazine that the information they gave on the children, the first casualties of the Chernobyl accident, this was 10 years after the event, and that they were so ignorant, Science Magazine, National Academy of Science, that they wrote this article stating that it was radioactive iodine. And what happened? They didn't. I tried to get them to acknowledge, and failed utterly, as I expected to say that the Poles had some Poles when the Chernobyl fallout was descending on them, and afterwards they dropped a tincture of iodine in water and drank it, which of course didn't apparently kill anybody, but it doesn't accomplish what the so those technical details, I think, have to be straightened out, and I failed to, in my attempts to influence either FEMA or Science Magazine or the other organizations to do anything about it.
Well, I certainly think it's a matter of education, but I would certainly challenge each one of you who do have the knowledge, who do have the experience, not to wait for the government to do this for you. This is something you can do for yourself, for the price of an old truck or a new smaller truck. Be an example.
Have a do what she's suggesting, not with anybody else in the country.
Sure.
Either a group of shelters, but in America.